Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 2 of New Scientist from the 11th of May. Last episode, I sort of read for about half an hour, then went extremely tired, and went through, and obviously this is to improve my reading. So there's articles that had LIGO detecting black hole neutron star mergers. It sort of gives you an idea of the distance and sensitivity of that. LIGO is the gravity wave detection system. It's got a huge amount of technology. They've got sort of rather stupid thing about finding primes by working out whether it's a prime, sort of exclusion, green revolution, sharks, asteroids spinning, emergency landing, a plane crashing. So I didn't really read all that much. I thought it felt I was going for hours going through it. Now I'm going to read up ahead. And I really can't remember whether last time I read the underground treasure troves. And so this is continuing paleontology news, page 14. Underwater treasure trove, pristine prehistoric bear fossils from Mexican cave is analyzed. So it must be one fossil. But then it says by Chelsea White. Fossils of the extinct bears discovered in the underwater cave of Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula have been dated to the end of the last glacial period. The Hoy Negro cave floor is currently 55 metres below sea level and would have been dry before the glaciers melted at the end of the last glaciation. The water has helped preserve the remains of various animals, including seven prehistoric bears of species Atocahelium wingi. So what I just want to say is it's actually pristine fossils to period. Divers brought up two intact skulls from the cave, one belonging to the ancient bear pictured and another from a wolf-like animal called the Procyonidetes. Collagen in the root of the bear's teeth suggests it lived 11,000 years ago. Not the collagen, the dating of the collagen. The collagen itself didn't suggest it. Hello, I'm some collagen. What are you doing? Hello, Susan? What are you? Go and put that in the suggestion box, but okay. The findings are helping researchers fill the gaps in our understanding of how animals migrated through the Americas. Now, it is interesting for me, this, I've got difficulty expression and I suppose processing. People would say me would have a processing problem there. The battle of the exomoon that may not exist. Now that's no moon. Evidence for that's what seemed to be the first moon ever discovered outside the solar system may actually be just a statistical blip or surprise, surprise. This is the second time that a closer look at the data has failed to show an exomoon, and we may never know if it really exists. Oh dear. Why not? In 2017, the New Scientist reported David Kipling and Alex Trechley of Columbia University in New York had spotted a possible exomoon orbiting a planet around Kepler-1625, the data from the Kepler Space Telescope. At the time, the researchers said the data was inconclusive and switched to the Hubble Space Telescope for another look. So the Kepler, these telescopes have gyros, and the gyros are the weak point in them. And I think, the gyros, I think there's five gyros, and you need at least two to do it, and they just successfully fail. It's sort of a nightmare. Meanwhile, new analysis of the Kepler data cast doubt on the conclusion. So when the Hubble observations seemed to spy a single Neptune-sized exomoon, it became the only solid evidence. They show a dip in the star's light as the planet passes between it and the telescope, and then another smaller dip attributed to the moon. Oh, that would be interesting. Same orbiting. But according to new analysis of Laura Kilberg at the Harvard Smithsonian Center of Astrophysics in the Massachusetts and her colleagues, the evidence isn't... is she analysing it, or is she analysing it? And her, I don't know. Kipberg used the same raw data as Kipling and Tetley, but it was processed separately. I tried my best to reproduce the exact steps the original authors used and found that I couldn't reproduce the results, said Kipberg. In her team's data analysis, the extra smaller dip of starlight was gone. It isn't clear why the two teams have reanalyzed each other's work, and neither of them has found a specific step that would make the two different. It's an astronomical stalemate. I like that one. Quote, neither team was able to identify anything the other team did wrong, says Kipling. That's frustrating. Others' findings that supported the X-Men hypothesis that the fact the planet seems to be wobbling remains solidly in Kidberg's reanalysis. This kind of wobble is often caused by a gravitational tug of either moon or another planet. We might never know what's going on because Kipling's and Tichy's request to observe Kepler 1625 with the Hubble telescope again in May was denied. Unfortunately, it's going to be the most impossible to confirm this in future. Well, surely the human race is not going to blow up. For now, it may be time to focus research, search for an exomoon elsewhere. Quote, it's only a matter of time before we find a great one, says Kubrick. I just don't think this is it. Okay. Interesting. Now, cobalt could be harvested from sea batteries. Now, so cobalt has got an odd number of proteins, so it is relatively rare. Now, cobalt is between iron and nickel. So it goes iron, cobalt, nickel, copper, zinc. So cobalt is less rare. Now, cobalt is named because it was mined, found with nickel, and tended to poison people. So nickel and cobalt are both demoned elements. Cobalt is a sprite, a demonic sprite, which killed miners, and nickel is old Nick. Let's look at it. It's amazing. This is by David Adam. Strings of plastic balls dangled in the ocean could gather enough cobalt from hundreds of thousands of electric car batteries. Wowee. Maha Jaji and Alexander Skolkin of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology says the system could harvest enough cobalt for the water to make the battery for each of the 250,000 Tesla Model 3s that have been rolled off the production line so far. In fact, repurposing 76 unused oil rigs off the Gulf of Mexico could produce enough cobalt for more than 500,000 electric vehicles' batteries every year. I don't know why they just say double. The growth in sales of electric cars mean the global demand for cobalt could outstrip the supply for the first time next year, according to the European Commission's Joint Research Centre, i.e. demand-supply curve. It might actually, the price may increase. But seawater is swimming with dissolved minerals. Yeah, because there's a lot of sea. There's not a lot of substance in there. The world's oceans carry about 500 million tons of cobalt, dwarfing the 7 million tons of identified land reserves. But 7 to 500 is, it's the economics may be totally different there. Of that 7 million tons, it's got a very high concentration, so billions of times probably higher. The study proposes filling plastic spheres, each about the size of a beach ball, riddled with holes with absorbent materials before dangling them. So you've got your beach ball, it's got to be, and you drill and you put something in it. Now, minerals such as algae or lemon peel would bind with the dissolved cobalt more than other minerals. Every few weeks, the balls would be dragged in to collect the cobalt. Surely, I just find this hard to comprehend. The technique has already been used to test the harvest of uranium. Cobalt is a bigger challenge because its concentration in seawater is about 8 times lower. I.e., even though it's formed by different methods, the actual uranium is an even isotope. Is an even number of protons. The study doesn't tackle whether the process could be cheap enough to be carried out on a large scale. However, one way to reduce costs would be to use waste materials such as recycled plastic bottles to make the balls. The team says further studies would need access to assess the environmental impact. Rather interesting. Yeah. It did 13 Reasons Why Increased U.S. Suicide, the next show widely criticized for seeming self-harm, but it isn't clear if it influenced suicide rates, says Jesse White. In the next show, 13 Reasons Why, 17-year-old Hannah kills herself in the scene that shows her suicide. Concerns that it could lead to suicide, contagion, in which explicit depiction of self-harm lead to people to copy the method, appear to have been borne out by the new study, but it may not be that simple. Jeffrey Bridge of Nationwide Children's Hospital in Ohio and his colleagues have analyzed the data from the U.S. Centers of Disease Control and Prevention and Suicide in the U.S. between 2013 and 2017. They found 28.9% rise in suicide rates among children from age from 10 to 17 in April 2017 as compared to the surrounding months, and the overall increase the following 8 months compared with the previous years. The rise was statistically significant in boys, but not in girls or adults, a Journal of America. Well, that's super significant, isn't it? But, yeah, the big question is, they sort of assume, you know, when it was aired, sort of, they should say prior to it's been seen. It doesn't make sense that boys would be the ones to show the reflex. Well, I don't know if boys have a high suicide rate. I think they have a high suicide rate anyway, and you could get statistics. It says, and whether boys watched it. It says Daniel Rummer at the University of Pennsylvania. It says the show is about the young woman. It would trigger contagion for suicides. It's not clear that it would trigger contagion phenomenon in suicides in men. Girls are more likely to attempt suicide than to kill themselves, says John Draper, to attempt it. This is the Natural Suicide Prevention Center in New York. So if the show had the effect on girls, it would be apparent in the data if the team looked at it. That's what I was sort of saying myself. Bridge and his team didn't respond to the requests for comment. Another, as yet unpublished study by Stephen Stacks at Wayne State University of Michigan and his colleagues gauged attention to the show on Twitter and analysed the US suicide rates in April, May 2017, so that's when it came. The months with the most tweets for boys aged 10 to 19, they found the increase in suicide rate of 12.4%, while girls saw it jumped to 21.7% compared to the previous months. Well, surely that's significant. This is more in line with the time period in which suicide contagion takes place. It reflects the gender split reflected for a show with a female lead, says Sam. Roma also studied the show's impact, surveying 729 people aged 18 to 19 before the second season aired to assess their vulnerability to risk and self-harm, and asked them again a month after the show was released. He found that people who stopped watching partway through the season exhibited high suicide risk and less optimism than those who saw the final episode. Well, that's interesting. Hard to work it out. But he also found that those who finished the series reported lower levels of suicide ideation and self-harm than people who didn't watch it. So, look, I must admit myself, I can't watch Game of Thrones. Yeah, when I'm feeling, when I had my heart condition and stuff like that, let's watch Game of Thrones and you see all these people dying and you go, oh no, somehow I just don't feel like watching that. I sort of, I don't know. Complicating the analysis, the general increase in suicide rates of nearly 10% among the 15 to 24-year-olds during 2017. My godfather, seasonal effects may also affect the play. Suicide peaks in spring, happy, everything's growing bright, though it's unknown why. Or maybe in winter, you take a while to get going. And when everything's happy, you want to do it. I think it makes it more depressing than happy people. It doesn't have to be this way. Draper says that for every person who dies by suicide, there are 280 who think seriously about it and don't kill themselves. The ratio is seen on the screen doesn't reflect the reality. But we need to flip the script, he says. The evidence shows that if you show people coping through the moments, associated reduction in suicide rates. Well, that's brilliant. It's the contagion of suicide support. Now, of course, unfortunately, there are, especially with the education department and their high stress way of doing things, there's suicides embedded in there. So you've got family and education department pressures. Animal Behaviour by Claire Wilson. Monkeys seem to turn to each other and solace after trauma. After a frightening experience, some people like company, and that might be true go for monkeys too. When a hunger and devastated a small island, its residents, rhesus monkeys, spent more time close to each other in the following months. Known as Monkey Island, the uninhabited island of Cayo San Diego in the Caribbean is home for about 1,500 descendants of animals taken there 80 years ago for medical research. 2 years ago, Hurricane Maria hit the region, causing thousands of deaths in nearby Puerto Rico and leaving many people without electricity and water. Most of the trees of the Monkeys Islands were damaged or destroyed. It must have been terrifying for the animals, says Sam Larson at the University of Pennsylvania. A tenth of the monkeys died in the storm, and their sources of food and water were disrupted. Before the hurricane, the monkeys were fairly standoffish and with unrelated individuals. The year after, they were more often seen alongside other animals, even unrelated ones. In one group of monkeys, were observed with another within 2 meter radius of up to 10 times as often as they did before the hurricane. This finding presented the meeting of American Association of Physical Anthropologists in Ohio. Larson says the company may have helped relieve stress. Alternatively, the lack of shade from the trees may have forced the monkeys closer together. Well, there you go. You know, how do you get this sort of thing? AR to keep an eye on traffic by Donna Liu. Machines will spot road accidents and a strange behaviour in the UK. Oh, don't know. You've got a problem here. You want it to really spot strange behaviour rather than behaviour which seems strange to be identified as, I don't know, I'll read it. Artificial intelligence has been used by the UK to detect traffic accidents by monitoring CCTV camera footage. The aim is for AR to alert traffic operators about the incident in real time, allowing them to act quickly. This is one of the first instances of the country of AR collecting transport data from public CCTV cameras, says Richard Cartwright of FlowX, a firm that is working with several councils on pilot schemes. The algorithm involved is trained to recognise 9 different types of road users, including pedestrians, cyclists, cars, trucks. Is that 4? Okay, there's another 5 categories. It will track their motion as well as they move through each camera's field of view. This month, Devon County Council started the use of the system to monitor live footage of their existing cameras. It will look for anomalies such as slow or stationary vehicles or vehicles travelling in the wrong direction. These will be flagged as potential incidents for investigation by staff who are charged with keeping the traffic moving and the road users safe. Well, if it's just a backup thing, well, don't get over rely on it too early. And that's sort of, if I can sort of say, that's sort of like my design philosophy of just build the systems and teach the bejesus, sort of test the bejesus out of them. Okay. A pilot study, I suppose, involving one camera has been agreed with the Leeds City Council, and FlowX is in talks with 5 other local authorities around the UK. One challenge in creating the system has been minimising the number of false alerts flagged by the algorithm. Quote, if you have 3 very similar vehicles driving along the road at the same time, you could get this a slow or wrong-way vehicle detection because the software thinks that one vehicle in one frame is different vehicle in the next frame, says Peter, building the technology firm Vivacity Labs, which is involved in the project. If there are too many false alerts, this could dissuade operators from using it, he says. However, reducing the system's sensitivity may mean that some instances are missed. Similar AI-powered traffic monitoring systems have been deployed in China, such as the City Brain project at Hangzhou, which is run by e-commerce giant Alibaba. Privacy concerns have been raised about the schemes like these because the technology can track individual road users as they move through the city. Identifying details of individual pedestrian or car won't be stored in UK pilots. The software only records the path a vehicle takes, what kind of object it is, a car or a cyclist, say, the timestamp. No video footage is being used, save by the algorithm, says Middleton. Although the pilot program won't use the number plates or face recognition, law enforcers and insurance companies may be interested in doing so in future to identify problematic drivers before accidents, says Emmeline Taylor, City University of London, whoever she is. Quote, that raises worries, quote, we know algorithms aren't perfect. There are real concerns regarding prejudicial profiling of drivers, she says. Yeah, you can really make up a case. Okay, see how far we can go. Closing on the mystery of how water got to the world got its water. So there is this basic thing that given the temperatures of the sun and the waters and surrounding rocks, we've got a hell of a lot of water is up the top of the earth. And so is it deposited or was it in there in the rocks? The earth may have formed, with its water baked in, dust samples from an asteroid revealed an unexpectedly large amount of water and rocks, like it may have been building blocks that made up our planet. In 2003, the Japanese spacecraft Hayabusa left for the 500-meter asteroids Itokawa Pichu. It later returned to Earth with dust samples. Itokawa is a S-type asteroid, whatever S-type means. These are thought to have formed fairly close to the Sun, so were expected to have very little water. Because of this, many scientists have hypothesized that while the Earth may have been built from S-type asteroids, it's got water later on from wetter asteroids and comets. Maitri Bowles and Ling Jin at the Arizona State University analyzed two mineral grains brought back by the Hayabusa. The results surprised them. Ithaca is bone dry with respect to anything in our human experience, but it's wetter than we expected, said Bowes. I should say what that percentage means. The asteroid was once part of a huge rock, says Bowes. The pair estimate this would have contained about half as much water as all of Earth's oceans combined. I find that just hard to calculate. It's bone dry. This is crazy. They also found water had the same chemical signature as that on Earth, not chemical isotopic signature. Water's got that. Water on Earth is the same water all throughout the universe. H2O is the isotope, so I wish they'd get that right. This suggests that water and all these, the Earth, Moon, and Mars, this suggests the water on all these bodies came from the same place, I suppose. Primordial pebbles that formed asteroids and when these worlds. In this scenario, there's no need for water to be delivered later on. Two missions at other types of asteroids are due to collect samples that may shed more light on this Leah Crane. That's really poorly expressed in terms of, people are saying, oh, do you understand? Yeah, you are dumb, you don't understand. It's just the words are difficult to understand. Ruby Process Scully writes, discovery could make CRISPR safer. So, clustered clustered regularly interspaced palindromic repeats. So that's sort of a metacode in your DNA which identifies a section of DNA your DNA is then stores strips of information to allow so CRISPR itself doesn't use CRISPR. So CRISPR used the Cas9 and the guide DNA, but the CRISPR refers to the bacterial DNA, which has the CRISPR sequence in it to create its guide stuff. So we don't use CRISPR in CRISPR. That's pretty amazing. Well, let's try and read it. Molecules act like off switches for the CRISPR gene editing system may one day make the changing DNA in people safer. Yeah, you betcha. CRISPR can easily alter genes. That is, you can have two squirt bottles and do your own genetic engineering on your top. It could lead to new treatments for cancers, viral infections, and genetic conditions. Well, pretty well everything, thank you very much. But as well as desirable changes, it could also make unwanted mutations in the DNA and a possible health risk, you betcha. Amit Chowdhury at the Harvard University has been looking for compounds that can help us more finely control CRISPR. He and his colleagues say that they have identified two molecules that may stop the CRISPR molecule system within minutes, might. To find these, they analysed thousands of substances looking for those that interfere with CRISPR's ability to bind to DNA. That doesn't really make sense to me. A requirement of being able to identify and alter genes. I don't know quite. CRISPR gene is used as a Cas9 enzyme for bacteria. So this is the cutting. Cas9 is the cutting bacteria, but it's the enzyme needs a information guide RNA to help it. Now, is it guide DNA or RNA? I've got to really think about that. The most commonly used version of CRISPR technique uses a Cas9 enzyme that is constantly switched on and raises the risk of binding to another DNA sequence and causing unwanted edits. The two molecules identified by Cowdery and his colleagues interfere with the enzyme's ability to recognize and bind with DNA. Well, it just switches it off. It just turns it off. My problem is that you're not stopping it making mistakes. The idea is that after it's done its job, it's more likely to do low frequency. Say if you've got low frequency, after 1,000 hours, it goes and makes the wrong thing. If it does all its work in 5 minutes, you may as well switch it off after 5 minutes. I've got a lot of difficulty in working out this. I have to reread it. Stop the process of serine, thereby reducing the risk of off-target mutations. Well, not mutation cutting. CRISPR's anti-CRISPR, larger anti-CRISPR proteins could had been developed earlier, but Crowdy says smaller inhibitors are likely to act faster and without prompting an immune response. When he and his team tested their molecules in mammalian cells and human plasma, they found they were non-toxic and did not seem to hinder essential genes. So they don't know whether it works, but we've tested them. Hungry hippos move vital silicon to river, obviously by the poop. And this is an RPS, whatever. Oh, but same thing. Ruby Prosser Scully. So her name is so long that, she has to be reduced to RPS. I love that. By eating huge amounts of grass and then defecating it in water, hippos are living silicon pumps, and the health of their habitat may depend on them. Oh dear. Every evening, hippos eat around 440 kilograms of grass and other plants rich in silicon dioxide, known as silica. So the plants tend to take this out as a defense against, to make sure that to tough them up for strength, but also it means that insects have to increase their muscles. It just raises the game. So you can't just have a lazy grub who's a bit sick and just munches through a mushy plant. So there's reasons it's still occurring up there. The day after, they lay in water where they digest and excrete it. Obviously their poo, their silicon. And now silica actually is interesting in that it, silicon pump. So silica is a silicon hard, it's basically sand crystals. To see how the animals move silicon in the ecosystem, Jonas Scherer at the University of Antwerp in Belgium and his colleagues looked at silicon levels in hippo-dominated ecosystems in southwestern Kenya. In one 250-meter stretch of the Mara River, they spotted 80 hippos. Far out, that's a lot of hippos. Analyzing dissolved and particulate silicon in the river revealed that hippos transported 400 kilograms of the element a day. So let's go, how many? 80 times 40 is 300 kilograms of grass. So that's, okay, that's believable. That's 400 kilograms of the element a day, or 76% of the total move throughout the ecosystem. Quote, hippos act as a kind of conveyor belt transporting silica from the land to water, says Shirka. So you want to get, silica has to, I suppose that's a huge silica resource. This is vital because signaling algae in water needs silicon, so they need silicon to build their outer skeleton. The algae provide food for other plants and animals, so that single cell things require an exoskeleton, or you can have it. But hippos have been killed and driven off the rivers that lead to Lake Victoria. If the population shrink further, the amount of silicon pumped into the waterways will fall. The plants and fish could be in jeopardy, says the team. Okay, well, I'm just... okay, I'll read this really, really brief. Pandas aren't as odd as we thought. By being picky about the bamboo, pandas managed to gobble as much protein as polar bears, because polar bears hang around and just do it in one big seal at a time. That is by preferring to eat the shoots to the rest of the plants. which may explain how these vegetarians manage to get by with a digestive system that is better suited for eating meat. Recognition for new type of dementia. New guidelines that make it easier to diagnose recently recognized form of dementia known as LAT. The condition appears, whatever that means, the condition appears to involve this happened form of the brain protein TDP43, which is particularly common in people of the age over 85. Young bees inherit disease resistance. This is interesting. How young bees inherit it must be some herd immunity, something like this. Bees have been found to pass immunity-boosting molecules to their larvae. Putting specific RNAs in the jelly fed to younger bees appears to provide colonies with a kind of collective immune system. This requires so much research. Now, this enables young bees to benefit from resistance built up by older bees. Well, that's pretty amazing. Okay. I'll just still have to put the microphone here. I'll stop because I've got to go off and visit and do various things. Thanks a lot for listening.
Okay, continuing to read the new Science. I can't quite remember why I had to stop last time, but I don't think it was because I was tired reading it here out in the sun. I've done, what is it? Oh, sorry, previously it's 34 minutes. I'll just do a bit more, wrap it all together. Just various things, getting medicine, going to meetings and stuff like that. Okay, continuing here, the last finish was about young bees getting RNA. So I do like this sort of group immunity that organisms together can go, but then you've also got the census, that when sufficient bacteria are on the surface, they decide to emit a chemical. So there's this sort of group biology going on, so it's as you go up. Okay, next one is fish feces to fuel submerged drains. Okay, so it says too, I think this is sort of one of these notional things, which this could be something we could be considering. Underwater robots could charge their batteries by eating the sea floor. The device created by the US Navy extracts electrical energy from fish feces and other organic matter to provide endless power. Wow. All underwater devices have fundamental limitations, battery life. They are useful for exploring and monitoring depths, but once the power starts to run out, you have to bring them to the surface or abandon them. Well, you just abandon them. One solution is to use microbial fuel cells, MFCs. The devices incorporate naturally occurring bacteria that can feed on organic matter in the sediment on the seabed. Many feces from fish, this entire thing is that the seafloor is raining continuously with dust and sediment and gulp. As they digest this, the bacteria shed the skeletons, shed electrons, causing a flow of current that can be used to power electronics in your wildest dreams, my friend. Maria Iris Throde at the Meharia at the U.S. Navy's Information Warfare Center Pacific in San Diego and her team have already used MFCs to power basic sensors such as ones monitoring magnetic fields. Oh, well. Which you want to do, because if a sub passes over, you want to know. Previously, the devices would last a few weeks underwater. However, one powered by MFCs lasted 8 months. In principle, MFCs can provide power identified as sediment is replenished by the slow fall of fish feces, dead creatures, and other organic debris. The main stumbling block is their low power density. You betcha. It would take 1 day to charge up an iPhone X and around 1 year to charge a small, uncrewed, underwater vehicle. Mm. As a result, a large array of MSCs will be required, or underwater vehicles that need much less power. Thank you for that brilliant input. I don't know who wrote that article. Norwals are doing swimmingly despite a narrow gene pool. So norwals are these porpoises with these long horns, unicorn horns, and I was trying to think through the Middle Ages that people would have unicorn horns, and I was trying to think who very valued unicorn horns. So you have to understand that in the Middle Ages people, I don't know, had a different worldview, and it was the ideas of animals being distinct from spirits and spirits and it was a very spiritual time, and they actually believed in these fantastic animals. The genetic diversity of narwhals is low, but this doesn't seem to be hindering them. The state of affairs usually makes the population of animals less able to adapt to change. But the Arctic whales, those with tusks in their upper jaw, are doing pretty well. And I think it's a double tusk, except that it grows and twirls together. Okay, it's like the normal tusks of a walrus, except it's in the upper jaw and it twirls together and goes forward. I don't know what it's used for. This suggests genetic diversity might be less vital than we think. Michael Westbury of the Natural History Museum in Denmark, on his colleague sequencing the genome of the narwhal in West Greenland, comparing the DNA of the narwhal inherited from each of its parents. Yes, honey? Okay.
Sorry, I just got interrupted there by a phone call, so I hope I can do. Okay. Such a set of affairs usually makes the population of animals less able to adapt to change, but these Arctic whales, famous for the tusks in their upper jaws, are doing pretty well. This suggests genetic diversity may be less vital than we think. Now, this is interesting in terms of genetic, like in maths, you can just pull down to a problem and say, get it to solve it different ways. You can pull down a column and you can get it to solve by evolutionary methods. And the strategies can vary depending on how much computer power you have going ahead. Okay, Michael Westbury of the Natural History Museum of Denmark and his colleagues sequenced the genome of the narwhal from West Greenland. Comparing the DNA of the narwhal inherited from each of its parents revealed much lower levels of diversity than normally seen in Arctic marine mammals, such as the beluga whale. Low diversity is often a result of inbreeding of a small population, but neither fits the narwhal, which is numbers around 170,000. Genetics suggests rapid population growth since around 115,000 years ago. And similarly, we can actually do genetic diversity and target our Adam and Eve. I don't know what they're doing that. Before that, there was a slow decline of about a million years, which might explain the lack of diversity. Doesn't seem a big deal. So, if you think the population crash, it can be can see important genetic variations lost. But a slow fall may have meant the narwhals preserved diversity where it matters. Okay, so they're not evolving quickly, but they're evolving in important points where it does. It also suggests that why did it come out? You've got the various ice ages happening, it's whether you've got predators, maybe, you've got the rises and falls, the different things. So if you have a rapid reproduction strategy, you can invest in that, but that is actually sort of whiplashes your predators, providing abundance and low amounts. So there's a lot of maths of what goes in. Friendly bacteria may curb eczema. Having a diverse mix of bacteria on your skin could help fight off eczema, suggests a probiotic ointment may eventually help treat the condition. Eczema affects many millions of children and adults. Previous research has found that they have more Streptococcus aureus, a common skin bacteria that it spreads more easily. To investigate, Richard Gallo at the University of California, San Diego, and his team colonized the skin of mice with S. aureus, and studied human skin cells from people without eczema. Oh dear, this sounds like poor science. Myself personally, I haven't really read it. In human cells, they found S. aureus used quorum sensing, a form of bacterial communication, to release toxins and enzymes that helped break the skin's barrier to better colonize it. So if you've got a single bacteria and you emit a toxin, you're just going to train the immune system up. So what you do is you build, you gather up, and then you mount a population attack which creates sufficient toxin to, you know, to create an open battlefield. They also found that other bacteria called in the Staphylococcus family encountered these toxins by secreting proteins that blocked porin quorum sensing. So it allows them to build up, and when it gives the go to attack, there's other bacteria which is not as active to do it. So that's really interesting. When the team put peptides isolated from these bacteria on mice skin inflamed by SRO, these curb the new flare-ups. So peptides is like you've got a protein and segments of protein is a peptide, so, but that does not quite make sense. Now, Gallo says, this is a boost for efforts to develop an ointment with a friendly bacteria for the skin. Oh, Godfather. Feel the Burn, and I don't know who wrote this one. Well, there you go, Feel the Burn. I can't see the author of this one. Okay, so it's by someone. This is a new layout. I've got some problems with it. The rise of vaping has seen tobacco firms revisit the old cigarette alternative, but the health benefits are far from clear, says Graham Lawton. So he's the author of it. My thing is that it's hard to say. We are going to get health interventions, but it's not going to be stumbling across. It's going to be an anti-aging pill or something like that. First there were smokers, then there were vapers. Now there's a tribe of nicotine users so new that they haven't got a name yet. They may well call them heaters or smolderers, but if the tobacco industry gets away, they'll become a familiar sight. A new tribe of converts to are called heated tobacco products, HTP, or heat not burn devices, HNB devices. Instead of incinerating tobacco, they warm it up, increasing the aerosol, nicotine, and other compounds that they inhale. They have been described as a hybrid of cigarette and a vape. See new hotness below right. The devices have been on sale for years, but tobacco firms have begun a major PR offensive in the belief that its time is right to win over more customers. Quote, they're very busy all over the world. It's a massive campaign, says Anna Gilmore, the Tobacco Control Research Group in the University of Bath, UK. Take Philip Morris International PMI, which is makes the leading product on the global market. Oh, how possibly working? IQOS is Iquit Ordinary Smoking. Last week, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, approved for sale. PMI says the device, which is already available in 41 countries and territories, is used by 10.4 million people. The great thing is that if you can wean people off, except people on cigarettes, which are cheap and available, and if you're rich enough, you get something and you don't die. There's nothing worse than someone in a village dying of smoking. That's a way that really calms your sales, doesn't it? Uses 10.4 million, a vast majority of ex-smokers. So the people try, well, this is the entire thing. This is a next, you don't want them to stop, you want them to continue allegiance. You just want someone to stop. If the efforts like these succeed, we can expect a return of the health debates that have raged over e-cigarettes used by vapors. Are HTV safer than smoking? Do they encourage people to quit or to start? I think it's a much more complicated thing. It means that you're creating a less diffuse idea of quitting. What are the long-term risks? The answers matter because tobacco industry is aiming at HTP at smokers who might otherwise quit or shift to vaping. The idea of heating rather than burning tobacco is actually nothing new. The first HTP was launched in 1988 by R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, but flopped commercially and was withdrawn the following year. The industry launched numerous devices after this, but smokers consistently rejected them. The early products were marketed at smokers worried about smell, ash, second-hand smoke. But now the industry has hit on a new idea, to sell devices as being safer. The logic is that because the majority of dangerous compounds in cigarettes are generated by burning tobacco, ditching the combustion should mean HTP is less toxic while delivering nicotine and cigarette taste. It's interesting that the heavy metals the plants take up heavy metals like uranium and stuff that, and that goes into the smoke. So it's like this whole concentration process. So if you drop waste on a metal waste on a thing, it will wind up in your lungs through the system. It's pretty amazing. The reason the industry thinks its time is ripe due to the success of e-cigarettes, says Theodore, a health economist at Harvard University. These have popularized the idea of safer smokeless alternatives, but have failed to satisfy many smokers. They often lack the throat hit, the sensation of smoke striking the back of the throat, that many smokers enjoy. PMI confirms the vaping's partial success has created an opportunity. E-cigarettes change smokers' thinking, says Maura Grist, head of scientific and public communications at PMI. But the rate of people switching from smoking to vaping is actually slowed down, so there's an opportunity to provide other alternatives. PMI admits that the heated tobacco doesn't eliminate the dangers of smoking. IQOS is not risk-free, says Gilchrist. And so what is IQOS? I quit ordinary smoking. The best thing a smoker can do is quit, but the firm insists it is less harmful to use HTP than smoke. It's safer, says Gilchrist. This time largely rests on PMI research showing that heating rather than burning tobacco generates significantly lower levels of harmful chemicals. It examined 58 compounds found in smoke that are known to be harmful to potentially harmful. Average across 58, levels of IQOS aerosols are 90% lower. An independent literature reviewed by Elkis Semenovicus at King's College London and his colleagues found a broad agreement with the figure. About 10 to 11 studies of the aerosol composition they looked at were industry funded, says Stimonovicus. Quote, the research findings from the tobacco industry support the tobacco industry's claim, he says. Indeed, most of the published research at HMP has been carried out by or funded by the industry. This raises concerns at certain glads of the University of California, San Francisco, because the tobacco companies have a record of publishing incomplete or manipulated information. You betcha. For example, in 2001, PMI, Philip Morris International Research, dubbed Project Mix, showing that including additives such as methanol in cigarettes didn't boost toxicity. In 2011, Gantz analyzed the internal company documents realized released through legal action. He concluded the data had been massaged to conceal the fact that additives did increase toxicity. Responding to the analysis, PMI's then chief scientist, Ruth Dempsey, said, quote, I'm of the opinion that the concerns of Project MIX are unfounded. Even if PMI's claims about HMB's altered chemical makeup is true, studies of aerosol compositions are a smokescreen. I love it, says Gantz. What matters is the biological effects of inhalation. He says that studies and others have done, both on PMI data and independently generated results, show by this measure. The entire thing is that if you really want to do it, you really have to create caches where your raw data is stored out of your thing. So if you want a proper study to be done, you have to do the study, transfer the study's pre-analysis to a vault, and then analyze it. And it must be, otherwise you can confiscate it. There has to be a way that you have a gold standard of a study done by a funded company, such that it can be later scrutinized. And then punishment going across. So the fundamental thing is that you must do all your data, the data stuff, and then internally it must be taken out so it can be later audited, sort of sealed in a vault. I sort of know what to do. This is the way intellectual property is handled. Another concern is the aerosol may contain harmful chemicals that aren't in the cigarette smoke because burning breaks them down. Quote, it's possible that HTBS delivers to their users a unique chemical mixture with a distinct toxicity profile, says Arinda Stepanov of the University of Minnesota. This means HTPS could lead to diseases not caused by smoking, says Gantz. PMI accepts that it isn't sufficient to simply know the aerosol composition, but disputes and that the fumes are equally toxic. Quote, we also completed toxicology studies, said Gilchrist, and all show significant reduction in toxicity. Up to now, however, PMI has failed to persuade the FDA of the validity of the health claims. Companies wishing to market, quote, safer smokes in the US have to apply the FDA recognition as a modified risk tobacco product, which is correct. PMI has filed such an application for IQOS, but in January 2018, the FDA Tobacco's Product Scientific Advisory Committee decided it didn't reach the required standard. The PMI submitted an updated approval last summer. Gilchrist says it's still under review and that the firm doesn't know when to expect the verdict. The FDA approval last week was to sell the device without making any health claims. In the meantime, independent evidence has begun to pile up. In a review of the literature on heated tobacco published this year, Bertrand Danzerberg of Sorbonne University Paris and Marie-Dominique Danzerberg of the pressure group Paris Without Tobacco analyzed the health claims. Well, they might be married, do you think, if they've got the same name? And, quote, heated tobacco produces less smoke than traditional cigarettes, but the risk reduction is not demonstrated, says Baron Detzebel. The pair also found evidence that non-smokers taking up HNB outnumber smokers using it to quit, and that 69% of the users continue to smoke as well. Well, there you go. So they're just topping up. Okay. Both fly in the face of industry claims that the devices help people quit. It's still too early to deliver a verdict on the health impacts of HTPS, let alone wider questions of whether they help smokers quit, but industry observers are skeptical. Quote, tobacco sales are declining globally, says Gilmore. Their longer-term business model is under threat. We have to do this. New hotness. IQOS is the leading not-for-burner product, a handheld device with a slot of sticks of compacted tobacco that resemble a very short filtered cigarettes. When you start the stick, the tobacco is pierced by a blade-shaped electronic heating element, which, when activated, heats the tobacco to 350 degrees Celsius compared with 700 degrees Celsius for conventional cigarettes, i.e. that's the burning of carbon. Inhaling on the filter draws the air through tobacco, producing a nicotine-laced aerosol. The experience is very similar to smoking a mild cigarette, a noticeable nicotine buzz and a throat hit, but no ash and very little odour. The device still isn't covered by indoor smoking ban in the UK, but people have permission of the owner to use them in a pub or other venue. Oh, IQOS main competitors are the Glow, made by the British American Tobacco, and Plume, produced by Japan Tobacco. Both launched initially in Japan, where e-cigarettes containing nicotine are illegal and are gradually being rolled out around the world. There you go. Working hypothesis, sorting out the weak supernova from absolute zero, whatever that means. This is blah. I think this is a comic thing. Blue Origin. Amazon's chief Bezos is expanding his delivery service with a rocket firm, Blue Origin. It has launched a suborbital flight with 38 experiments and gravity return sender, so I think delivery service here. Beach lovers. We now have an antidote for the Australian box jellyfish, the world's most venomous animal. Luckily, it doesn't involve urinating on yourself. I think there's supposed to be jokes in this. Honey, in a shocking discovery, campaign group Action on Sugar revealed that honey contains sugar and it isn't as healthy as Bee Lobby lets us think. It's supposed to be a joke. Food scientists searching for suitable sources of protein have made sausages from flour larvae. Maybe just go vegan. Germophobes. The UK decided against ditching the 1 and 2 pence copper coins, which have been found to carry antibiotic-resistant bacteria, so no change here, haha. So this is sort of like the weak version of dad jokes. Okay, so now what they've done is that they've put views, non-scientific contact things, into columns, letters, something called aperture culture, and culture columnists. I don't know. Okay, us versus the gadgets. UK plan to stop household gizmos plotting against us forgets that we are the weakest link, says Chris Storkel Walker. Storkel Walker, what a great name. You will soon be able to sleep easily in your bed knowing that the kettle in your kitchen is no longer plotting to take over the world. That is what the UK government would have its citizens believe. Well, the entire thing is that, I think, that sensors which confine themselves to sensing their own state are not as bad as a sensor which goes out there and listens to you. It depends how smart you want it to be. That is what the UK government would have the citizens believe in. So you can have a sensor which senses the environment and then speaks to the individual sensors. So it's the entire network of sensors here. It depends. It's got a little non-linear danger with it. That's what the UK government would have its citizens believe. Anyway, on the 1st of May, it announced that plans of laws regulating internet-connected devices, the gizmos that together make up the Internet of Things. The legislation, if introduced following consultation, will introduce a labelling scheme to assure buyers that any product given the stamp of approval is safe to connect to the internet. The government is proposing that any internet-enabled devices that doesn't display IoT bench, a checkmark, couldn't be sold under UK retailers. Manufacturers will be able to attain a checkmark by ensuring that the devices have a unique password not kept on default, easy to guess factory seconds, like four zeros, and that they would have a public point of contact to disclose any vulnerabilities found about the state for how long they will provide the software updates to patch the vulnerabilities. Oh, sounds weak to me. The proposal come at the right time. In part, the current furore of the Chinese firm Huawei's involved with the UK planned 5G network stems from an envisioned future of internet-enabled consumer gadgets, from kettles to televisions to voice assistants to washing machines worldwide. Estimated 75 billion connected devices are forecast to fill our homes by 2025. Wow. And that's 75 billion devices that could be hacked to allow someone to siphon off personal data, for example, or to launch a malicious raid. So the important thing is that your kettle is networked into your main devices. It's not the kettle itself, it's the mesh, which is important. So I don't think doing a password on your devices is important as a weak link. The danger is very real. In 2016, before IoT began to take off, Muriel botnet attack infected countless devices and turned them against the targets in DDoS attacks, denial of service attacks. Internet security firm McAfee has highlighted a serious vulnerability in smart plugs and digital assistants akin to the Google Home Hub and Amazon Echo. A visitor to Shohan.io, a website that trawls the internet looking for internet-facing devices accessible to anyone because they have no security or rely on default passwords, will convince anyone of the merits of tighter regulations. All very smart, then, up to a point. The biggest flaw in the UK government's plan is just a second. The presence of devices may help raise awareness of the need to keep IoT devices updated to patch vulnerability, but experience shows on average users like to school every update and they are prompted to. If any government is serious about tackling the problems of leaky devices, it needs to recognise that often the problem isn't the devices itself. Manufacturers should be compelled to push out software updates at regular moments. And as much as it might annoy us if we want to sit down to a nice cup of tea and binge watch Netflix only to find the kettle and the TV are updating, the average user can't opt out. We're inherently lazy people and usually don't fully understand the care of technology works or why the integrity is important. No single label, no matter how shiny, is likely to fix that. Truly trusting the kettle in the next room will require something more. I don't think people really understand what the kettle can do. I think it's the fact that it's a networked, you know, patch. Okay, this is a view by columnist. Look, I don't quite understand here. But it's hashtag facts matter. What are really only 100 Aren't there really only 100 harvests left? Headlines that warn that our soil is becoming so degraded that we may be heading to agriculture Armageddon. Can that be right? James Wrong investigates. Okay. When it comes to science reporting, there are some headlines that are so frequently repeated, so intuitively plausible, so aligned with our cultural beliefs that it seems like incontrovertible truths. The general public, and indeed many scientists, may fervently believe these claims reflect the overall scientific consensus. However, sometimes when you dig a little beyond the surface, the evidence underpinning even the most ubiquitous headlines can seem surprisingly shaky. Perhaps the best example is of such an assertion is the impending agriculture Armageddon caused by decades of irresponsible farming practices that have degraded soils across the planet. So the press narrative goes. A quick scan of the headlines reveal that despite the confidence with which these forecasts are proclaimed, the actual timescale for D-Day varies rather widely from story to story. While some of the reports say we have 100 years until the end of our soil's ability to support farming, citing the University of Sheffield studies, other claim that's a mere 60 years away, referencing the speech from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Recently, the UK government's environment secretary even stated that the UK is a little 30 years away, eradication of soil fertility because we drench it in chemicals. If this is indeed a likely endgame scenario, we should probably determine which of the estimates is most plausible, 30, 60, or 100 years. So let's take a closer look at the claim. Despite dozens of headlines quoting these predictions, surprisingly only one peer-reviewed paper for the scientific journal has ever cited an evidence to back them up. The 2014 studies from the University of Sheffield compared the oil quality of a range of sites in an English city, including agricultural gardens and allotment soils. Now, before we question whether the result of this single small study can be extrapolated to represent all England, let alone the whole UK, or even the whole world, let's take a look at their findings basically. Some of the urban soils in Sheffield are higher in carbon and nitrogen than some nearby agricultural ones. Okay, but where's the 100-year statistic? It turns out nowhere in the study is there any calculation predictions, even passing reference to the claim. None whatsoever. Perhaps not so much a shaky evidence to support this assertion is as much as non-existence. Maybe this is the result of a typo in the work of another research paper. After an 8-hour trawl through the academic journals failed to pull up a single study of even attempted to make the calculation, I contacted 6 leading soil scientists across the world to ask if they had ever come across such predictions. I love that. This is really good. That is, you don't look for the data, you look for people who might know the data. Published literature of their work. Not a single had. The fact that the words they used to describe the claim were bold, too Malthusian, hardly useful, almost insulting, and I have used this in my soil science lectures to show the students to be wary of headlines. Ouch. Does this mean that there aren't real threats to the agricultural soils around the world? Absolutely not. Indeed, all scientists I spoke to went on at great length to point out where they exist. However, they also highlighted how incredibly complex and calculations need to be to make such a prediction would be. Based on the... Have you fun time at tennis, Reepy? Are you going to meet Toby there? Okay, goodbye, Reepy. The boring reality is that soils in some parts of the world might be in decline, others are not. Furthermore, while agriculture may be one of the factors driving the erosion of nutrient depletion, many modern farming practices, such as no-till and synthetic fertilizer application, may actually be helping alleviate rather than drive this. In fact, according to many objective measures, modern evidence-based farming techniques are more sustainable than those of the idealized past. Quite a different picture painted from the headlines. So despite the thirst for simple truths in a complicated world, the researchers I contacted agree the setting the figure of an agricultural endpoint would be nigh on impossible, which may explain why no published studies appear to have done so. But this hasn't stopped the newspapers. Welcome at 2019. That's rather a beautiful article. Okay, we're into letters. Hopefully I've read there's more to this paper. Okay, there's a comic here showing a robot destroying towns. Don't look at me like that. My team only created the jet propulsion system. and that appears to be functioning perfectly. Jet-powered rocket. Why do we care what we're made of? Colin Barris reminds us, this is by Mandy Meikle, Wolford's West London, UK. Now remember Meikle's? Colin Barris reminds us that our 300 trillion human cells are outnumbered by 39 trillion microbes, a more accurate representation than Thomas Lucky's 1970 estimate that microns outnumber the human cells 10 to 1. But over 80% of the human cells that make up our bodies are erythrocytes, also known as red blood cells. Oh, this is interesting. This contain no nucleus or organelles, are simply packed with hemoglobin, the molecule that transport oxygen and carbon dioxide from our tissues. Some might say they're not true cells at all. But why would anyone care about the ratio of human to non-human cells in our body? Consider how many DNA-filled human cells carrying our genes are presumably contributing to our sense of self, are replicating on our bodies compared with those of non-human cells. Just under 7%. In the end, does it matter? I like that person putting in some data. Okay. So hopefully, how air pollution, may cause teen psychosis. Now, oh, Guy Cox. I wonder if this is my Guy Cox person. Your report by Helen Fisher and others linking air pollution to vehicle exhaust with teenage psychosis. You say that it isn't clear how air pollution might be linked to psychotic experience. The children studied were born in 94 to 95. The fuel additive triethyl lead was banned from the UK in 2000. So children may have been 4 to 6 years exposed to lead, which is known to affect the brain. Areas that now have high levels of nitrogen oxide would then have had high levels of lead pollution. Also on the topic. From Judith Town, London, UK, Adam Vore is right to note the correlation between exposure to air pollution and teenagers. Psychosis isn't proof of causation. It's a smoking gun, though. Is that air pollution is consistently worse in areas where poverty is concentrated, with all such psychological stresses it entails. It's extraordinary that the study found that 30% of the teens surveyed reported at least one psychotic episode. That's pretty, you know, what do they mean? Editor writes, we didn't mention that researchers did control for poverty, and they had no data for lead. So this is just, you are writing to a sophisticated people, and any article you write is not going to cover absolutely everything, but this is where the letters really work in. Working hours and mental health. Okay, by Paul Nugent of Wantage, Oxfordshire. While discussing the effects of cutting work hours, Michael LaPlache quotes a study of Hong Din of the Australian National University showing that men with unpaid care commitments could manage about 30% more working hours than women with such duties, without experience of decline in their mental health. Such a dramatic disparity surely warrants a closer examination. There were the 8,000 participants randomly selected, were there 50% male and 50% female? Would the differences be attributed to men being less comfortable discussing their mental health than women? All these questions. What constituted an unpaid care commitment? There is a big difference between buying groceries and caring for an elderly relative, for example. The type of paid employment and the levels of status and remuneration could also have a significant effect on employees' ability to sustain mental health. LaPlache pointed out that to make assumptions about working hours based on male needs is detrimental to women's interests. It is actually also detrimental to the course of gender equality to report differences in possible working hours without a more nuanced analysis. I agree with that. My relation to religion is different as a woman. Okay, this is interesting. I don't know how this goes, because it looks... Oh, yeah, sorry. Harvey Whitehouse reviews evidence of religion's role in human civilization, but he makes no attempt to distinguish between differing social needs of women and men. Formal religions are staffed by a ruling elite of men who, I believe, have the fundamental goal of regulating women's sexuality. Isn't that beautiful? Get to Proximus Centurion, small step at a time. Mike Smith, Bellevue, Washington, U.S. Gilmet Emmett reports a plan to send a gram-scale to Proxima Centauri. Expecting that these could get back to us is a fantasy. The amount of power 1 gram payload could generate can't be more than a few watts. For comparison, a New Horizons spacecraft uses 15 watts transmitted to reach us from Pluto. Plans to get to Proxima Centauri should be incremental. Start with more modest lasers and much bigger payloads and solar sails, then work on improving each of the various components. It isn't the people who need to be forced. And what they're doing here is this beautiful graphics here. They're showing a small picture of the paper, of the page that they're referring to, and giving the article, so it's really good. A study investigated people are willing to do voluntarily to reduce their carbon footprints. Concluded, not enough. I think people would be happy to do far more if everyone had to do it. So it's our leaders who need to be forced to make the necessary laws. Social engineering to change travel and diet by Rosemary Sharples, Penhurst, New South Wales, Australia. Adam Vaughan notes that the European Academies of Science Advisory Council urges the European Union to change its stance on transport, which is curbing mobility, is not an option. Social engineering has given us a transport situation that we have now. They built it and we use it, but social engineering can bring change. It has often been demonstrated that reducing road capacity reduces the amount of travel. There is a forced curb on people's mobility. The individuals decide themselves how much they will change their activities. Most opt to vary their route or travel at a different time. Some go greater lengths, including changing their travel mode or domicile. Also, by Eric Calvin, S. Les Essat Leroy, France. Vaughan suggests caps on personal travels to reduce carbon emissions, but if capped travels could be traded, a rich person could buy travel from a poor people who were happy to accept a market price for it. This would be equivalent to a fuel tax that raised the cost of the price, and those proceeds would be distributed evenly. I would do a tax would make everyone happier than the cap method. Taxing meat to consumption is curious. Many of us are already taxed in order to make it cheaper. The only step needed for governments is to stop subsidising meat and dairy. Doing so absorbs the majority of the EU's agricultural budget, which itself comprises 40% of the EU budget. Subsidies are also high in the US. That's an important point. Smart streetlights should set street speeds. Oh, that's interesting. SAMEG suggests fitting streetlights with motion sensors to save energy. I would go further and provide a rolling corridor of light in rural areas. It would move along the road ahead of the vehicle. I don't think so. It might have been added a benefit of nudging compliance with the speed limit if the light travels with the limits. I like that idea. Oh dear, it also could be dangerous. Meetings with famous primates and cultures. I love the picture. So this is so sensible. These people have really thought this out. New Scientist, congratulations. Your articles on chimpanzees losing culture brought back memories. I took an elective course in anthropology as a freshman at the University of Illinois in 1961, but I had no real interest in the field. One day, our professor came out with a burly gentleman who he introduced as an anthropologist, Louis Leakey, who was travelling to California to announce a major discovery by a student named James Goodall. We were astonished as he showed us Goodall's photos of chimpanzees using branches to catch termites and ants, clearly demonstrating what we had learned in class a few weeks earlier, which was that humans aren't people using stools. If chimpanzees are losing culture, the idea that they may eventually lose their tools, skills, is sad. Women sniff dogs with observes, sniffs dog and observes its epilepsy. Okay, I don't quite understand that one. I do remember reading it. I'm not surprised that Emile Carter and her colleagues find that dogs can smell when someone has had an epileptic seizure. The reason for this is that I can smell when my dog has had one. My dog's seizures are generally well controlled by medication, but even if he has a small one, even in the middle of the night, I know because of the telltale smell, an arid pong like no other. It seems to come off his saliva. Since becoming a dog owner, I have realized that the human sense of smell is better than we realize. Isn't that a beautiful thing? Now, I don't quite understand the structure of this magazine, but I'm going to finish that there. And there's views on culture, hunting the future. Okay, thanks for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.